Life sustains itself by cell division. So does cancer. Breast cancer cells multiply faster because of CDK4/6 proteins. But what if we could block those proteins and stop runaway cell division? To that end, Dana-Farber scientists laid the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, new drugs that are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Dana-Farber's momentum of discovery keeps finding new ways to outmaneuver cancer. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
How many jobs did the economy create last month?
Yeah, crickets. From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles. Hello, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org. Today is Friday, September 2nd.
Happy Friday, Jeremy.
Happy Friday.
The federal government is about to tell the big banks, we're going to see you in court.
On this Labor Day weekend, there's plenty of expensive gas, and pretty soon we'll see expensive beef.
And later, some dirt's being moved on a big lot in Las Vegas. What's going on there? Not much.
All that ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
News this morning from the Labor Department. The economy didn't create any jobs and didn't lose any jobs in August. And the unemployment rate didn't change either. It remains at 9.1%. Jill Schlesinger is editor-at-large at CBS MoneyWatch. She is with us from New York, as she is every Friday morning. Hi, Jill.
Good morning.
So the takeaway here, does this confirm that the economy is officially and literally flat?
Yeah, we are neutral. The U.S. growth has stalled in the first half of the year, and as a result, employers really did pull back on new hires. I know the whole debt ceiling and August volatility didn't help, but, you know, those employers who needed some extra hands, they hired part-timers. The number of people working part-time who really want full-time work, that jumped to 8.8 million from 8.4 million in the previous month.
And those are people who don't have benefits either, right?
Exactly.
Part-time workers. Now, President Obama, Jill, goes before Congress on Thursday to unveil a new jobs program. Let's say all the obstacles are out of the way, okay? The Republicans are out of the way and all his obstacles are gone. Is there anything that the president can do to create some spark?
Well, you know, if there were no obstacles at all and rivers ran with chocolate, we could create a 21st century version of the New Deal Works Progress Administration. That would create tons of jobs. They might be low wages, but it would add to the debt. And I just think this comes back to the old debate, spending versus debt. And there are risks and rewards for both. But if we are not going to do a big program like that, I'm kind of concerned that we're stuck here in neutral.
And the realization?
Oh, gosh. The realization is that this, you know, we just went through a 10-year horrible period where things were fantasy land. And now we're swallowing the bitter pill. The bitter pill is it takes time to recover from a boom and bust. And this bust period is going to persist and it's not going to change. That's the price we pay for going on that binge.
And we're
going
to see if people have the patience for that. Jill Schlesinger from CBS Money Watch. Jill, thanks.
Take care.
Well, let's get another take now on the big zero jobs number today from the Labor Department. Chris Lowe is chief economist with FTN Financial in New York, and he joins us now as he does every Friday. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, zero jobs, that seems like a new one.
It is actually a new one. It's the first time there's been no change in non-farm payrolls since 1945.
Wow. And what's the reason for it?
Well, in part, we can blame the Verizon strike. If not for the strike, it would have been up 45,000. But, you know, behind the strike, there's really widespread weakness. Almost half, 48% of companies shrank. In August, the 52% grew. So there are job losses all over the place, including government, which cut 17,000 workers this month.
And Chris, we're talking about 9.1% unemployment, and a lot of people are now looking out a year or 2 years down the road and saying we're going to be about the same at that point. When can we get back down to 5%?
Well, that's right. You know, even the White House yesterday posted its new forecast showing about 9% unemployment at the end of next year. I think the answer to that question is in the answer to what caused the recession and the sluggish recovery, which is debt. It's very much like the 1930s and the 1970s in the sense that we had this debt binge. And it takes years to work through it. Good news is we've had about half the number of requisite years under our belt already. The bad news, of course, we probably have another 5 years to go, at which point the unemployment rate will fall much faster, but it still takes another maybe 5 years after that to get all the way down to five.
Five more years. Chris Lowe, chief economist with FTN Financial, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, the Labor Department is also planning to release something else today, a proposal to extend the list of farm jobs, it says, are too dangerous for kids. And as reporter Sally Herships tells us, it's causing a lot of controversy in the farming community.
This summer, two 14-year-old girls were killed while working in an Illinois cornfield. They were electrocuted by an irrigation system.
And that's a measure of the kind of hazard that we face. The likelihood of death for those kinds of child workers in agriculture is far greater than children working in any other industry.
Don Villarejo is director emeritus of the California Institute of Rural Studies. He says farms employ only 2% of U.S. workers, but a quarter of all children killed on the job work in agriculture.
So it's a really very disproportionately large share of child workers in ag who die as compared to other industries.
Farm jobs, he says, are dangerous. So Villarejo says he's pleased the Labor Department is publishing a new list of farm jobs that will be off-limits to kids under the age of 16. Banned areas include grain elevators and silos. Some work with animals will also be restricted.
With animals, you know, what does that mean?
John Thompson works with the Idaho Farm Bureau Federation.
Does that mean the kids on a farm can't go out and milk the cow anymore? Can't feed the chickens? Doesn't seem to make sense, and it seems like it's an example of the federal government poking its nose where it doesn't belong.
He says, of course, no one wants kids to get hurt, but he doesn't want family businesses hurt either. The new Labor Department rules exempt children working on their family's farm, but lawyers at one agricultural trade group are being careful. They're advising some members not to hire their kids. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
The federal government is on the verge of filing lawsuits against the nation's biggest banks. The New York Times reports this morning that the suits will accuse the banks of selling bad mortgages during the housing boom and saying that those mortgages were top quality. The government mortgage companies Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac lost more than $30 billion.
Let's go to Nelson Schwartz, who's a reporter for the New York Times, for the latest on that story. Hi, Nelson.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. So there are so many issues with the housing crisis and with subprime mortgages. What are these lawsuits about?
Among the big losers in the mortgage meltdown were Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the housing, you know, mortgage giants that are controlled by the U.S. government and therefore taxpayers lost. They're filing suit against the big Wall Street banks to recoup some of those losses.
It's been, what, almost 3 years since the federal bailout of Fannie and Freddie. Why are they doing this right now?
The regulators are concerned that there is a three-year statute of limitations and from when Fannie and Freddie were taken over, and that anniversary is Wednesday.
How are the banks, do you think, likely to respond?
The banks are saying that these were sophisticated investors who knew the risks and knew these securities were not guaranteed, as well as the argument they're going to put forward is that the problems are caused by a broader downturn in the economy and broader problems in the housing market, not any kind of fraud or misrepresentation on the part of the banks.
I'm curious, Nelson, say Fannie and Freddie do win these suits. Could that help the housing market?
Hard to say whether it would help the housing market itself. I think it would help the taxpayers, but the housing market is really, you know, looking at a big overhang from all those foreclosed homes.
What about the banks? What would happen to the banks if they take this hit, billions of dollars?
I think it would be a hit to their earnings, and I think it would sort of confirm investor fears that they're going to be paying out billions of dollars for years because of what transpired during the housing bubble.
New York Times reporter Nelson Schwartz. Nelson, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, for another perspective on this, let's bring in Elliot Spoon. He teaches mortgage finance at Michigan State University's Law School, and he's with us from East Lansing. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, do you think that this is a winning argument for the federal government?
I think it is a good argument for the federal government, but it is not a slam dunk lawsuit that they can win. There are a number of obstacles that lay before them.
What do you think the banks are going to say?
I think the banks are going to say, number one, we didn't make any material misstatements. Two, that we didn't know about the misstatements because they came from the mortgage originators. And three, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, you're big, sophisticated investors. You know this business better than we do, and you have to rely on your own expertise when making these kinds of investments.
Is this really about recouping losses, or is this about assigning blame for the mortgage mess that led us into this recession?
Well, I think it's about both. I think that anytime one of these lawsuits are brought, one party is essentially trying to say, I was innocent. I was just acting in the ordinary course of business. So in that sense, it's about one party saying, I'm not to blame, and the other party is. But it also, as a necessary consequence, has to allocate the losses. In this case, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have already been supported by the taxpayer, upwards of $150 billion. And so if they win this suit, it will soften that blow for the taxpayers, but it won't have any material effect on the mortgage market.
If the federal government wins this case down the road, however long it takes, and the banks have to cough up another $30 billion, doesn't that then put the financial system in a weakened position and therefore weaken the entire economy?
I think there's something to that. I think that one of the unintended consequences is that if these kinds of suits prevail, and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are not the only parties that are bringing these type of suits against the banks, in this case, it might help the taxpayer in the short run by lessening the amount we have to fund Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. But if it ultimately weakens seriously major banks, taxpayers are going to have to give the money right back.
Elliot Spoon teaches mortgage finance at Michigan State University Law School. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Some numbers now. Netflix stock has taken some big hits after news leaked about a breakdown in negotiations between Netflix and Starz Movie Channel. Starz provides Disney and Sony movie titles for Netflix streaming content. The current contract runs through early next year.
More evidence of trouble for chain store The Gap. The discount chain Ross Dress for Less is about to overtake The Gap in market value, Steve, even though Ross Dress for Less only has a third as many stores and no online sales.
Wow. Yeah. You can check out the numbers anytime, by the way, at our website, marketplace.org. Also, follow our show on Facebook and Twitter.
And you can follow us individually, too. I am at Jeremy Hobson on Twitter.
And I am at Radio Cheeto.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
Well, it is almost Labor Day weekend, Steve.
Yeah.
For us, we're literally just a couple of hours away.
And I think we're both laboring, aren't we?
That's true. We will both be laboring on Monday.
Holiday.
But at least we get Saturday and Sunday. So probably there'll be some barbecues going on this weekend. But if you are a meat lover, you better savor that barbecue because the price of beef is headed for a stampede next year and beyond. And the reason is deep in the drought of Texas, as Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports.
This is a story best told by ranchers living the drought. Guys like Pete Bonds.
Hello.
He's got a whole lot of cows.
Tens of thousands.
And not enough water.
The worst drought I've ever seen.
And even the old-timers, he says?
A bunch of old men that have seen the droughts of the 50s and the 30s and even the teens.
Even those old men haven't seen a drought like this one.
This one, it is just flat forgot to rain.
And ranchers who don't have rain don't have a lot of choices. They can buy hay, but hay is expensive because hay is grass and grass takes rain.
And where it has rained is a long way away from Texas.
So ranchers are sending their cows to the slaughterhouse, the older ones first. David Anderson is a livestock economist in Texas.
We make a lot of hamburger out of older cows.
He says right now, hamburger prices are lower than they would have been without the drought because more cows are being killed. But that's a problem for the future.
Because every cow that's gone now is one less calf next year, which is going to become less beef the year after that.
And that means higher prices. Anderson expects the cost of hamburger to go up first, sometime early next year, and the price of T-bones and roasts to jump in 2013. I suppose you could call it the high stakes of the Texas drought.
I mean, if a cow is even thinking about getting old, she goes.
I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Well, millions of travelers are going to be taking to the roads for the holiday weekend. Jeremy, are you going anywhere?
I am indeed. I'm going down to beautiful San Diego.
San Diego.
San Diego.
Santiago. That's right. We won't continue that. No, we won't go any further than that. Gasoline prices, though, you're going to probably fill up, right, before you go down there.
I am.
Gas prices are near the highest they've been this time of year ever, a national average of $3.63 a gallon. And the high price is one reason, Jeremy, you and I are using less gas. As Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
For 9 weeks straight, America's drivers haven't even burned up all the gasoline and diesel pumped out by domestic refineries. And that means the U.S. has been a net fuel exporter.
We peaked in terms of U.S. gasoline consumption a few years ago, and we're not likely to approach those numbers, regardless of population growth.
Tom Kloza is chief analyst at the Oil Price Information Service. He says the slowing demand is partly due to the idling economy. But greener cars and trucks are also having an effect.
Fuel efficiency is unstoppable.
Yesterday, automakers reported hefty sales of smaller gasoline-sipping cars and hybrids. Jessica Caldwell follows the industry for Edmunds.com.
A lot of these smaller cars now are a lot more attractive than they used to be. I mean, they used to be just, you know, total econo boxes that no one really wanted. But that's definitely not the case today.
Even though we're using less gasoline, 80% of demand comes from overseas. And as long as those economies keep growing, there'll be expensive gas here at home. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Well, while we're talking driving, Allstate Insurance, Steve, has a report out this week ranking the 200 largest cities in America when it comes to safe drivers.
Okay.
Any ideas of who the winner might be?
The safest driver?
The safest city in the country in terms of safe drivers.
Probably somewhere with a low population, maybe somewhere in like New Mexico, Maine, Nevada.
Colorado.
Colorado, okay.
Fort Collins, Colorado, where the average driver will experience a collision every 14 years.
Okay.
The national average is 10 years. As for the road scholars, if you will, who could use a bit more schooling.
Road, R-O-A-D. I just got
indeed.
That.
Indeed. Drivers in L.A. get in a crash every 6.6 years.
That's not good news.
And the home of the worst drivers?
New York?
It's Washington, D.C. Every 4.8 years in D.C., you get in a crash. Although, having lived in Washington, D.C. for a few years, I can tell you, nobody lives in D.C. for more than 3 years, so... They probably don't live there long enough to get
okay.
in a crash.
And that's certainly more than a presidential term. So
That's right. We've got the list from Allstate at marketplace.org.
And now the Marketplace Global Perspective. Leaders of Libya's National Transitional Council, the NTC, spoke at an international summit today in Paris. And there, European leaders agreed to a series of measures to help the new government revive Libya's stalled economy. From London, here's Marketplace's Stephen Beard.
The 63 nations at the summit, including the US, China, and the European powers, gave full backing to Libya's new leadership. And they offered the NTC help to get the economy going. The summit agreed to unfreeze Libya's frozen assets. That could mean as much as $15 billion will soon be released. Charles Gurdon of the risk assessment firm Minas.
I think it'll obviously make a big difference because it means that salaries will be able to be paid, essential imports will be able to come into the country, and it will make a big difference, and it'll certainly tide over the NTC for a number of months.
The EU also lifted its sanctions against 28 Libyan entities, mostly ports and oil companies, and the summit promised to help combat the shortages of food, water and medicines that threaten Libya with a humanitarian crisis. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
And now, Marketplace Sports.
Ah, we need a sound effect for that,
though. We do, like Scott Simon on Weekend Edition, indeed. We should have a good little theme song. Okay. The city of Baltimore, Steve, is gearing up for its first ever Grand Prix auto racing event this weekend. Dozens of cars will race on city streets at speeds approaching 180 miles per hour.
Wow.
But drivers aren't the only ones taking a big risk. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports the Grand Prix isn't expected to make grand profits.
Under a tent in downtown Baltimore, technicians put the finishing touches on a Lola Mazda race car.
They're doing a little bit of wiring work, some small body work, just final spit and polish, really, for the race on Saturday.
Tom Mapplethorpe is team manager for Oryx Racing. His team will compete in Saturday's American Le Mans Series race. The temporary course winds past Camden Yards in the Inner Harbor. Jay Davidson is president of the Baltimore Grand Prix. He says the event could bring $50 to $60 million to the region from ticket sales and tourism, not to mention freshly paved streets. But the promoter expects to lose money, at least at first.
We're going to have somewhat of a loss this year. And basically the idea is to create, you know, event equity where people want to come back and mark this on their calendars. They come back year after year, and then ultimately this can be a profitable event.
Other cities have struggled to stay fixtures on the racing circuit. Detroit suspended its Grand Prix during the recession. Terry Engstad of IndyCar says a race in June in Milwaukee didn't sell well.
If you turned on the TV, there weren't a lot of people in the grandstands. So it was just a tough one for us. I wish we could bat 1,000. We don't.
But Engstad is optimistic for Baltimore. He expects grandstand tickets for Sunday's race to sell out. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Well, some other engines are revving up this weekend, Jeremy. Week one of college football is underway.
This is like the big time of year for you.
You're absolutely.
A big college football player.
Yes, Alabama Crimson Tide. They're playing Kent State.
You know, I grew up in Champaign-Urbana, and we never had a decent
Fighting
football
Illini.
Team. Well, but they were always terrible, and so I never became a big college football fan.
Because you didn't have a great team.
We didn't
team.
Have a good
That's
team.
Not
no.
good. Well, the University of Miami plays Maryland on Labor Day.
But it does so, Steve, under a dark cloud, as the NCAA investigates claims that a prominent booster and convicted Ponzi schemer provided players with money, jewelry, and even trips to strip clubs. The accusations are so over the top that some sports analysts wonder if the NCAA could shut the football program for at least a year, the so-called death penalty.
Well, only one Division I college football program, Jeremy, has been dealt the death penalty from the NCAA. Southern Methodist University, SMU, in 1987. I remember it well, actually. And the punishment created economic shockwaves in Dallas, where Southern Methodist University is. Thaddeus Matula directed the ESPN documentary Pony Excess, which chronicled the SMU story. He's with us now. Good morning.
Good morning. Glad to be here, Steve.
What happened to Southern Methodist after the NCAA handed down the death penalty?
If you look just at the conference that they could have been in, the Big 12, it averages a payout of $10 million a year per school. Now, the entire conference that SMU is currently in, Conference USA, the payout for the whole conference is $3 million. You're looking at 15 years, that's $150 million, and then you're not even looking at television deals and what you're getting at the gate. And I think it's also important to look at what it's done to the city of Dallas and the extra revenue that you've lost from hotels and people coming in and shopping and all that kind of stuff that goes around a game day weekend.
The problem at SMU was very economic in nature. Isn't that right? I mean, it mostly boiled down to money.
Certainly. I mean, we never really found extensive player arrests. There wasn't academic fraud. It was basically just making sure these kids had money to go out on a Saturday night, and that got out of hand a little bit.
And the accusation in Miami is much more nefarious than that. If the hammer does come down on Miami and they do get the death penalty, do you think the economic consequences will be similar?
Oh, yeah. I think Miami will suffer. It's not just that year or those 2 years. This is decades, because it's going to force the university to reevaluate whether they even want to have football. And if it does come back, it's going to come back in a much more reined-in manner. I mean, because this is a major black eye on the entire institution, not just a football program.
What was it like being at SMU? Your dad was a professor there.
Still is.
And still is a professor. I mean, you really had a front row seat to all this.
SMU was amazing. I mean, it was big time football, my man. You know, then they get the death penalty. I mean, 2 years without football. And for me as a kid, to go 2 years without something that I loved, I just can't imagine if I would have had gone without Star Wars. You know?
Thaddeus Matula, director of the documentary Pony XS. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Anytime.
And finally, there is not much construction going on in Las Vegas these days. You go to Vegas quite frequently.
Not as frequently as you do, Steve.
No, that's true. Well, the housing market, Jeremy, is a complete downer there, as you know, and no major casinos, to my knowledge anyway, are going up this year. So what do you do with all that heavy equipment and dirt? One company is charging people as much as $750 a pop for everyday non-construction workers. These are just everyday folks who get out of their cars and go and jump on a backhoe or a bulldozer to move dirt around. They're charging people to do this. Of course, they have to do a 10-minute tutorial
first. Just go. This is just like something you do for fun. You get on the thing and move dirt around.
Yeah, but you have to do a little class, you know, to learn how to run this big machinery. And you also have headphones on as well, so they speak to you in the headphones and tell you sort of what you're doing right and what you're doing wrong. So I guess it doesn't get out of hand. Do you know what the company calls itself?
What?
Dig This.
There you go.
It's really the name. Dig This. Amazing. So something to do next time you go to Vegas.
I'll keep that in mind next time I'm walking between the Bellagio and
that's
the
right. Yeah, the high roller over here.
You know, maybe we don't need to go to the pool today. Let's just go move some dirt around. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
Have a great weekend. I'm Steve Chiatakis. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.